Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 15th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today by video link, we have Ben Rubin and Debbie Evans. Welcome to the programme, both. Now we're going to start with extremism. And of course, everybody will know by now that Michael Gove stood up in Parliament yesterday to launch a new definition of extremism for the UK government. Let's have a listen to a few seconds of what he said.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And with your permission, I'd like to make a statement about the next steps that we are taking in the government's strategy to counter extremism and to build greater national resilience and social cohesion. The United Kingdom is a success story, a multinational, multi-ethnic, multi-faith democracy, stronger because of our diversity. But our democracy and our values of inclusivity and tolerance are under challenge from extremist groups which are radicalising our young people and driving greater polarisation within and between communities to further their own ends. As our new definition makes clear, extremism can lead to the radicalisation of individuals, deny people their full rights and opportunities, suppress freedom of expression, incite hatred, weaken social cohesion, and ultimately, it can lead to acts of terrorism. By today, my department is publishing an updated, more precise and rigorous definition of extremism, alongside a set of cross-government engagement principles for use when engaging with external groups. There is also detailed guidance on what the definition does and does not capture. And we're also setting up a new counter-extremism centre of excellence in my department as a world-leading authority on best practice, data and research.
So the important thing to notice here is this is for the use of government and so on. We'll come on to that a little bit more in a second. But first of all, I want to play a couple of seconds of what George Galloway had to say in response.
It's quite clear that there's a shared endeavour going on between the two front benches. But as questions have continued, it's quite clear there's unease on both sides of the House on the back benches, and for very good reasons. It is obviously true that this is part of a culture war wallpaper that's being created for the general election soon to come. It's not good enough to say that it doesn't seek to ban or jail anyone. You try getting a bank account once you've been branded by Michael Gove as an extremist.
So as I say, this has no legal standing as such, but I think that final point from Galloway is extremely important. And we've seen this type of thing in the past with people being denied bank accounts for being involved with certain types of campaign groups and so on. So an extremism tag is not going to be helpful. And it's not what happens legally here that matters. It's what happens in the corporate world, for example. With social media and so on. Now, the Gove, very, very keen to, and he keeps saying it, this is nothing to do with restricting freedom of speech. Well, we'll have a look and see in a second about that and so on. So anyway, before we get to that, let's have a look at the actual definition. So here's what they have to say in the document. The threat from extremism has been steadily growing for many years. While the government and its partners have worked hard to combat this threat, the pervasiveness of extremist ideologies in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in Israel on 7th of October 2023 highlighted the need for further action. So they say that extremism is the promotion or advancement of an ideology based on violence, hatred, or intolerance that aims to. Now, before we look at the aims, of course, there's quite a bit of difference between violence, hatred, and intolerance. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit later and an extra. But anyway, that aims to, one, negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms of others, or two, undermines, overturns, or replaces the UK's system of liberal democracy and democratic rights. That's an interesting one. Or three, intentionally creates a permissive environment for others to achieve the results in one or two. So they go on then to look at the aims that may be involved here. So what aim one that they define is negate or destroy fundamental rights and freedoms. And they say behavior against this, they define this as behavior against a group or members of it that seeks to negate or destroy their rights to live equally under the law and free of fear, threat, violence, and discrimination, including, for example, using, threatening, inciting, justifying, glorifying, or excusing violence towards a group in order to dissuade them from using their legally defined rights and freedoms. M2, they define as undermine, overturn, or replace liberal democracy. And they say that this is all about attempts to undermine, overturn, or replace the UK's system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights, including advocating that the UK's parliamentary democracy and democratic values and rights are not compatible with their ideology, and seeking to challenge, overthrow, or change our political system outside of lawful means. And the first point I would make here is that, of course, this might be viewed as looking at things like Islamism or similar types of ideologies. But of course, I would make the point that the parliamentary democracy that we have at the moment is not compatible with our constitutional arrangements. And so does this apply to people that are campaigning for a return to the tenets of the British Constitution? Well, let's see what else they say here. Let's move on to the next one. So number M2 also includes using, threatening, inciting, justifying, glorifying, or excusing violence towards citizens, fair enough, in order to dissuade them from participating freely in the democratic process. But of course, we've got to see this in the context of the narratives that have been built over the last few days and weeks about threats to members of parliament. And therefore, we are not allowed to, we want to prevent people from protesting outside of constituency offices, for example. Then they go on to say, subverting the way public or state institutions exercise their powers in order to further ideological goals, for example, through entryism or by misusing powers to encourage or encouraging others to do so. Now, entryism is where somebody from a campaign group surreptitiously decides to get themselves into, for example, the Conservative Party. We've got almost no sitting Conservative MPs that are prepared to stand at the coming general election. So, of course, there's plenty of opportunity for entryism here, where people would go in to the Tory party and attempt to get a place to stand in election as a Tory, when in fact what they are doing is getting that Tory seat in order to pursue some other ideological aim. And then M2 continues by going on to say, using, threatening, inciting, justifying, glorifying, excusing violence towards public officials, using including our armed forces, police forces, and members of local, devolved, or national legislatures in order to dissuade them from conducting their obligations freely and fearlessly without external influence. We sort of covered that already. And here's the kicker for me, establishing parallel governance structures which, whether or not they have formal legal underpinning, seek to supersede the lawful powers of existing institutions of state. So this government and this parliament, because this is absolutely supported by the Labour Party as well, is panicking about people sidelining the parliament that sits because they no longer believe in what it stands for. And setting up their own parallel institutions, whatever that be, schools, hospitals, whatever it happens to be. They do not want this to take place. That is viewed as extremism, and they are not going to support that in any way, shape, or form. M3, then, is all about enabling the spread of extremism, and they define that as intentionally creating a permissive environment for behaviour in M1 or M2, including providing an uncritical platform for individuals and representatives of groups or organisations that have demonstrated behaviour in either M1 or M2. This doesn't just apply to Islamism or whatever your bête noire is of the day. This applies to everybody. It goes on to say the dissemination of extremist propaganda and narratives that call for behaviour in either M1 or 2. Well, just by coincidence, of course, Hope Not Hate just happened to put their latest State of Hate 2024 report out on the same day, at the same time that this announcement was being made by government. I asked myself then, did they get a heads up that government was going to announce this on this particular day? UK column featured in this report, as it usually is. And I just want to mention this article here from David Frost, the former civil servant. The fight back against people who hate Britain has begun. This isn't just about people that would be classified as hating Britain. This is about people who actually hate, if hate is a word that you want to use, what our parliamentary democracy has become and want to do something about it. So let's put that back on screen for a second and look at what he had to say. He says, none of this has legal force. It's guidance for government, nor is it about freedoms for speech. I think that's wrong, but anyway, it doesn't ban any organisation. It doesn't stop anyone saying anything. It just means that on the basis of what an organisation says or does, the government can decide not to interact with it, appoint its representatives to quangos, or give it taxpayers' money. I can't see what's wrong with that. Indeed, I approve of it. Well, actually, I believe it is all about freedom of speech. And again, just by coincidence, Ofcom publishes this at the same time. Encountering violent online content starts at primary school. And of course, this is all about extremism in schools. So lots of things going on at the same time. But Ben, I'm very interested in your thoughts on this, because it seems to me government is using the smokescreen of extremism from the usual groups to cover something which is actually much more broadly based.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben. I'm an extremist, according to Michael Gove. I think they're panicking. I think that building parallel systems is the route out of this craziness. And I've been doing a lot of work around this, you know, over the past few weeks. So to see that pop up yesterday was kind of remarkable, actually. And yeah, it's not about protecting anybody. It's certainly not about protecting children. It's about maintaining the status quo. That's all it is. And suppressing fundamental rights and free speech and all of the things that we rely on for a well-functioning civilization.
I didn't agree with Galloway about his point about this just being something with respect to the election, because, as I've said, this is something which is supported by both parties. There's nothing to differentiate between them here, so it's not going to become an election issue. But his point about bank accounts, and the fact is that once you get on one of these lists, it starts impacting your life. This is a tricky area.
It's a very tricky area. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we saw the high profile case last year with Nigel Farage being debanked by, I believe it was Coutts, wasn't it?
Yes.
Maybe we're going to start seeing this play out more broadly across the population. Maybe we'll have problems in the coming months. Who knows what's going to happen? But I think that, you know, my definitive view on this is that it's one of those classic things, right? Like the more that they try to lock this down, the more draconian they become, the more fervent and the pushback will be.
Yes, indeed. And I'll just say to anybody that's skeptical, you know, anybody that uses terminology like "what can we do," we just do what we're doing because it's having an effect. This is clear. The Parliament getting extremely concerned about what's going on in the country at the moment, and this is not the right response, in my opinion. But anyway, Debbie, let's move on then to health issues. Welcome to the programme.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. Well, we've been reporting for a very long time on abuse and neglect of people in hospital and in care homes. And indeed, we've just interviewed one of our very own UK column viewers and subscribers, Hilary, about the treatment that her mum received in hospital. And that interview will be going out in the next couple of weeks, so please watch for it. But this next article from The Independent, I can say now that actually they're starting to catch up. So they're saying that elderly people are being treated like animals, left begging for care. So this segment is for you, to the chief nurse, Ruth May, Dame Ruth May, because this should never, ever be happening. Let me introduce you to Thomas Giles, who was treated like an animal. He's 96, from Mersey and West Lancashire. He was found semi-naked, distressed, delirious, choking on his own vomit because he was so heavily sedated. Next, we have 99-year-old Catherine Hoddell, who says that she was better off at the vet, Queen's Hospital, Burton, Derbyshire, had a fractured spine. She was sent home with paracetamol, but when she was readmitted, her family found her the next day looking woeful with a dead woman in a bed next to her. Next, we've got 86-year-old Joan Stevens, treated like meat, a former nurse at Stoke Mandeville Hospital. She had a fall. She was left in soaking pads. She was fed, but when she was fed, she had the food shoveled into her mouth so quickly she nearly choked on it. She went into hospital mobile and came out immobile. Next, we've got 94-year-old Rob Gladding, who was left in soaked sheets. He comes from Poole, and he had an overflowing catheter bag. And this is just simply heinous. This should never be happening. It would never be happening on my watch. So going on from there, let's look at AstraZeneca. AstraZeneca have now invested £650 million in Cambridge's life sciences cluster and Liverpool vaccine manufacturer. And AZ are set to be working with the UK HSA. I can't see that working out well. But let's remind ourselves, AstraZeneca, Sir Pascal Soriot, who has received the Terra Carta seal. And let's remind ourselves that AstraZeneca are very busy convening global health leaders to accelerate action on climate. So we very much have a partnership with King Charles. And for those of you that are watching No Smoke, the Green King, you might find this interesting because, of course, AstraZeneca and Sir Pascal are part of King Charles's climate task force. So staying on vaccines, the UK HSA have just broadcast, published or posted the latest video on children's vaccines. And what I find so disturbing about this very short video is this is children as trusted messengers promoting vaccines to other children. Let's have a look.
Our generation's risk of illnesses, like measles and whooping cough, is rising.
If we're not vaccinated,
we're not protected,
and could get seriously ill.
Risk of lifelong disabilities.
Are your child's vaccines up to date?
I find that advert very disturbing. And just to conclude this health segment, Sir Christopher Whitty, our Chief Medical Officer, has been popping up again at Gresham, and he's been delivering a lecture. This time, as we had warned you just before Christmas, he's busy talking about earthquakes, tsunamis and volcanoes. And in particular, he was focusing on the UK. And with regards to earthquakes, he says that earthquakes can occur in many places, but most are small. And we do have a few small earthquakes in the UK, but he felt the need to highlight that. And then he also wanted to focus on tsunamis and tsunamis in Cornwall. So as I'm in Cornwall, I better be careful, hadn't I? And he was referring to the Cumbre Vieja volcano in the Canary Islands. But let's just look at or listen to what he had to say, a very short clip from his lecture.
So the tsunami that occurred in Indonesia was the largest one in recorded history, but they've occurred multiple times through history. They're most well described in Japan, which actually named tsunamis. But you can also get tsunamis occurring in Europe, and I've just chosen the Lisbon tsunami of 1755. So this was a major earthquake followed by a tsunami, and the tsunami went through Portugal, out to the Azores, went along North Africa, France, and actually hit Cornwall, where it was described as having a wave of about 3 meters, still very large, and great loss of life. Numbers are not clear. So you can certainly get tsunamis affecting here. In deeper history, we've had very major tsunamis occurring in the UK, for example, from landslides in Norway, falling off large mountains. The Canary Islands, in theory, could cause a tsunami at the other side of the UK. So any country that has got a coast potentially is at risk of tsunami from somewhere else.
Debbie, I think that Chris Whitty, as Chief Scientific Officer, should be more worried about the tsunami of poo that comes out of our water companies these days.
I have a lot to say on poo. Maybe we can talk about it in extra. But what does Chris Whitty know that we don't, perhaps?
Good question. Okay, now, Ben, let me welcome you back to the programme then. And we're talking about AI, but we're beginning with Tortoise Media.
Going on at the minute about AI, what is it, how do we deploy it, and how do we regulate it, importantly. Tortoise Media are right in the centre of this, and they're right in the centre of a lot of the discussion going on in the country at the moment. We're going to be talking about them quite a bit this year. So they're a new news business set up in 2018 by a bunch of former BBC and Times newspaper people. Their mantra is slow down and wise up. The idea is that this is a counterpoint to the rapidly accelerating 24/7 news cycle. It's actually, you know, kind of what's required, but unfortunately their editorial direction is certainly not one that we'd agree with. And actually, this is really a way of buttressing and reinforcing the rapidly deteriorating globalist mainstream media narrative being put forward by people like Michael Gove. So they're a modern media org. They've got a website, as you would expect. You can look at articles, podcasts, videos, books, stores, basically what UK Column are doing, but with a very different editorial line, as I was saying. I believe that the tortoise name is a reference to the mascot of the Fabian Society, which was used up until the 1960s. And the Fabians are a not-so-secret society of Marxists working to implement a single global government. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it? They're funded, extremely well funded.
Right. Sorry, Ben, just to clarify, this is Tortoise funding, not Fabian Society funding.
This is Tortoise. Yes, exactly. Yeah, this is Tortoise funding through strategic partnerships with a bunch of big international corporations and government bodies. They sit right in the thick of this bunch of international money. As I said, they were founded by a load of ex-BBC people, including this guy, James Harding, who we can see on stage here on the left-hand side. He's the editor-in-chief, and he's here hosting the Tortoise Responsible AI Forum at Waddesdon House near Aylesbury last week. This is a big showpiece conference, one of a series that they host on under the responsible theme. So it's responsible AI, responsible investment, a whole bunch of other themes. We actually spoke about responsible investment one towards the end of last year. And regular viewers will remember James Harding from Gold's House in Davos. And here he is stood in front of Satan, as we've spoken about extensively on the show over the past couple of months. Now on stage alongside him, they had a real stellar cast at this event last week. So the first person of note was Meredith Whittaker, the president of Signal, the non-profit messaging app, which I've actually heard is backed by the FBI. Now talking to Channel 4 News last year about the UK's online safety bill, she said what is specified is a regime that would give Ofcom the power to demand that everyone in the UK download spyware that checks their messages before they're sent against a database of what is permissible to say and what is not permissible. And I don't believe that the Act was changed substantially between that comment, that analysis, and being enacted. And she would have been able to explore that in detail at the Tortoise event because the Ofcom chief, Dame Melanie Dawes, was also there speaking on one of the panels. So Melanie Dawes, obviously the UK's censor-in-chief, looking to dial up her powers, which she's been recently given. She was joined at the event by Nina Jankowicz, the former executive director of the Disinformation Governance Board at the Department of Homeland Security. That's here on the right-hand side, also known as the Ministry of Truth. And she spent a princely 3 months violating her fellow citizens' First Amendment rights before being bounced out of the role because she is a complete and utter lunatic, aren't you, Nina?
Honouring is really quite ferocious. It's when a huckster takes some lies and makes them sound precocious by saying them in Congress or a mainstream outlet. So disinformation's origins are slightly less atrocious.
Oh dear, that's a slightly longer video, but it got cut off for some reason. I don't know why. So Nina, you're a nutter, but you spend your time, and this is the provenance. These are the people getting invited in by Tortoise and a whole bunch of other people to talk about the regulation of artificial intelligence, but then as an extension of that, free speech, how society runs. There are a bunch of highly strung liberal women at the center of this discussion. Nina Jankowicz is just an exemplar of that. And she goes around nowadays speaking at events like this one, How to Be a Woman Online, You've Got to Deal with Gendered Digital Hate, Harassment and Violence. So there's this idea, I think it was actually, we saw it in the one of the videos shown earlier, this idea that what you're encountering online is violence or hate. It's not violence, it's derision, Nina. We're laughing at you and we're picking holes in your absurd, poorly informed worldview, and you hate that, which is why it feels like hate, yeah? Who else was there? Imad Mostak, the CEO of Stability AI, one of the big AI companies, who had a bit of a drama this week because they were caught stealing data from a competitor. Yeah, and actually you can see here this little quote from LinkedIn. The entire business model for AI is based on copyright infringement, right? So this company had actually hacked into one of its competitors' platforms to gather information. Not very responsible, right? But he's being invited to these events, right? And nobody was talking about this at the event, so far as we know. This is all done behind closed doors, by the way. Like, there's no recording of these discussions. We don't know what was agreed, what was specified, what plans were set out. It's extremely unaccountable. Who else was there? Finally, last but not least, Matt Clifford, who I spoke about last week, is the chair of ARIA, the UK DARPA, who's working to radically transform the lives of your children using a bunch of your taxpayer money. And just this week, ARIA has announced a new £42 million fund to redefine the current compute paradigm and deliver AI at 1/1000th of the cost in order to facilitate the global digital control grid that these people are building and that they're getting together at Waddesdon House to talk about. Yeah, lots of big conversations going on behind closed doors, but who's controlling it? As we said, this was at Waddesdon Manor. This is a palatial pile in Buckinghamshire, which is owned by the Rothschild Foundation. So all of this is happening under the auspices of the Rothschild family. In fact, James Harding's post thanked them as the sole partner to the event. These are the sensible discussions that are being led by Tortoise Media. Where does that take us to? It takes us directly to Israel, right? So the Rothschild family have their foundation. It has a counterpart in Israel called Yad Hanadiv. You can actually see here, if you flip back one, actually, Mike, we can get this up on screen. You see the Rothschild Foundation on the left-hand side, Yad Hanadiv on the right-hand side. They use the same mark, logo, crest, whatever you want to call that, the five arrows bundled together, tied up with ribbon. That is the Rothschild Foundation. And Yad Hanadiv paid for the design and the build of the Israeli Supreme Court. You can see here from the Israeli Supreme Court website, Lord Rothschild, recently deceased, second from the right, in this portrait by Paul Benny, the British artist, and also included in here have a bunch of Israeli leaders, Shimon Peres, Yitzhak Rabin, Isaiah Berlin, and others. And here we can see the final completed Israeli Supreme Court in the foreground, including what appears to be a Masonic temple on the left-hand side, right? Like the pyramid with the eye. There's an enormous amount of symbolism inside this building, as well as the Knesset in the background, which is the Israeli parliament, which was also funded and built by Yad Hanadiv, meaning that these buildings, the state they represent and the powers behind them appear to be directing and controlling Tortoise Media and all of these discussions around responsible AI investment, politics, democracy, whatever it might be that are going on in the UK right now.
Just to correct one thing there, Ben, you said FBI funding Signal. It was the CIA. We're funding Signal. So Signal was set up originally with CIA seed money in order to create a private messaging network that could be used by CIA assets in foreign countries for regime change operations and things like this. But the CIA has actually removed its funding at this point. And so Signal is perhaps got a slightly shaky financial future. But anyway, we can talk more about that in extra as well. Now, to talk about AI regulation, let's look at what the EU announced yesterday, which was the adoption of its new, what they describe as landmark law on called the Artificial Intelligence Act. Let's just have a look at what the Internal Market Committee's representative is saying about this. Thanks to Parliament, that's the European Parliament, unacceptable AI practices will be banned in Europe and the rights of workers and citizens will be protected. The AI office will now be set up to support companies to start complying with the rules before they enter into force. We ensure that human beings and European values are at the very centre of AI's development. So if you want to know a bit more about this, they have another article here on their website, which is entitled EU AI Act, First Regulation on Artificial Intelligence. They talk about unacceptable risk. And they talk about one unacceptable risk, which is absolutely banned under this act, is cognitive behavioral manipulation of people or specific vulnerable groups. And they give an example, voice activated toys that encourage dangerous behavior in children. I'm going to give another example. Would it rule out what SpyB did in the UK during COVID, which was to use the media to increase a sense of personal threat. This is exactly what the EU has apparently banned now with respect to AI, but that doesn't stop it happening, of course, in general. Let's just bring that back on screen and move back to the next unacceptable risk, social scoring, classifying people based on behavior or social economic status or personal characteristics. So AI can't do that. So this seems to be ruling out the possibility of some kind of social credit system, which is AI driven. I would just bring Michael Gove on screen at this point, because, of course, social scoring might be perhaps whether you're identified as being an extremist or not. But apparently in the EU, AI is going to be prevented from doing this, but not in the UK, I would suggest, because we don't have any of this kind of regulation. The next unacceptable risk, biometric identification and categorization of people and real-time and remote biometric identification systems, such as facial recognition. We're running as fast as we can in this country to implement this kind of stuff, but the EU has apparently banned it. I will believe that when I see it, but that seems to be in the act at the moment. But what are we doing here in the UK? So let's put that back on screen and have a look at what the Council for Science and Technology and also the US equivalent at the Office for the President of the United States are up to. They're saying that they've issued yesterday a joint statement on science and technology, and they're saying the world faces complex and interconnected risks from climate change to biodiversity loss to aging societies. The COVID-19 pandemic illustrated the complexity of hazards that transcend national borders and the critical role of science and technology in identifying, preparing for, and mitigating global risks. They went on to say that the two organizations in this joint statement thus met on the 14th of March 2024 in Washington, D.C. to discuss matters of shared interest. We focused on the role of science and technology in responding to global challenges and the potential for the UK and USA to deepen cooperation around emerging technologies such as artificial intelligence. And they also said that they recognise other topics of importance to the bilateral UK-US science and technology relationship and identified the following areas of mutual interest: energy security and climate change, healthcare, synthetic biology, public trust and engagement with science and technology. So that last one is really particularly interesting because, again, they're really concerned the public are not trusting what they're being told with respect to science and technology. But the underlying undercurrent of all this is artificial intelligence. So sticking with the UK then, the AI agenda is moving on because the EU may be trying to regulate to some degree, but in the UK we're not. So we are now using AI fraud detection tools with respect to sanctions. So they're looking at 18,000 sanctions records, including those issued in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And therefore, they're going to be using AI to look at 1,000 World Bank debarment records as well, including entities debarred from World Bank contracts. And they're going to use that AI to try to track what's going on there. But the question is then, what should the UK government be doing with respect to AI? Let's have a listen to Ruth Kelly from the National Audit Office and see what she has to say on this.
Artificial intelligence could transform public services, and government believes AI could save taxpayers billions of pounds per year by improving productivity. Our report looked at how AI is currently being used in government and what its plans are for future AI use across departments. We surveyed government bodies and we found that while AI is not yet widely used, 70% of surveyed bodies are piloting or planning AI use. Some examples of where it might be used include analysing digital images, automating routine checks, and summarising text. If government is to realise the benefits of AI, it will not only need to adopt new technology, but also change business processes, address data quality, and update ageing IT systems. It's also crucial that government tackles skills gaps and the risks of unreliable or inaccurate outputs from AI. We're recommending that government's overall programme for AI adoption is ambitious, and that it supports this program with a realistic plan to tackle barriers to AI's use.
So they're aiming for an ambitious use of AI within government. And you'll notice there that she mentioned specifically analyzing digital images. Would those be facial recognition images? She didn't specify. We'll keep an eye on this. We'll talk a lot more about this in Extra. Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, you would like to support us, please go to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out are there. And we do need your support to keep doing what we're doing. So please head over there if you possibly can. You could pick something up at the UK Column shop. But please share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org, ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Debbie, your new blog is up.
Yes, and that actually tandems in very nicely with the last segment that you did, actually, Mike, on AI, because our hospital's going to be automated in the future. Will we see the presence of human beings in hospitals? Maybe not. A little bit about parrot fever. NHS staff are now blaming us, the public, for discrimination. And also, if you do happen to be a shopper at the North Face and you want 20% discount, you'll now have to take an ethnic and diversity course before you're allowed the discount to your shopping. And more.
Okay. Thank you, Debbie. And just final thank you to everybody that signed up for the Climate Science Masterclass with David Siegel. You can find out more about that at climatecourse.ukcolumn.org. But anybody that has already got a ticket for that, he will be in touch today or tomorrow with more details. As I say, we're opening a second time slot. So Tuesday, 7 p.m. is as planned. It's the first time slot. There'll also be a Thursday time slot as well. But you'll hear from him in the next couple of days. If you don't hear from him in the next couple of days, and you've organized to join us for this, please contact us, because I think there's at least one person whose email address bounced. So we do, if you did sign up for that, please do get in touch if you don't hear anything from us in the next day or so. Okay, Debbie, back to you and life sciences.
Life sciences, yes, indeed. And we're going to be talking about Professor Sir John Bell, who's the Regius Professor of Medicine, University of Oxford. And he is the architect and the champion, if you like, of the UK life sciences programme. So here we've got the life sciences industrial strategy update, just to show you that he's the architect and he wrote the foreword. However, he's stepping down from his role in Oxford now, and Oxford University announced it just recently in February. Regius Professor of Medicine Sir John Bell to step down from Oxford role. And then they went on to very proudly tell you about his achievements. Well, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about Sir John Bell's achievements, because they haven't quite put everything in. So let me tell you that Sir John is 71. He's Canadian. He has Canadian and British citizenship. He was born in Canada. He studied medicine on the back of a Rhodes Scholarship. He went to Magdalen College, Oxford. And then here are some of the names that he's been involved with. And just to give you a flavour of who he is. So we're talking about the Institute of Molecular Medicine. We're talking about the Wellcome Trust. He founded the Wellcome Trust Centre for Genetics. He's a non-executive director of Roche Pharmaceuticals. He served on the scientific advisory board at AstraZeneca. He's a trustee now of the Rhodes Trust. He's also a member of Cancer Research UK. He's head of Genomics England. He's a member of the Jenner Institute, and he attended the 2013 Bilderberg. So you're getting a bit of a flavour of how important in the life sciences agenda Sir John Bell is. But recently he's been saying that we could be heading for another pandemic. And this article in The Express, ex-COVID chief makes stark admission about the future. We'll definitely get another pandemic. Isn't that reassuring? But the revolving doors keep on coming. And if you do go back to my blog, and I always try to include as much about these people as I can in my blog, so please check up on them. In 5th of March, you can see that I've written about him there, and he's had all sorts of involvement. The revolving door spins: Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca. He had to sell £773,000 of shares in Roche because he was doing a deal with the government on testing. So, I mean, you know, the revolving door is absolutely immense. But he was appearing at the Select Committee, and I've just got some short clips because Sir John Bell isn't backward in coming forward. So he was talking about the Moderna deal, about vaccines. Let's see what he said.
So I think because, to be honest, we did really well with vaccines in this pandemic. We had two types of vaccines. We had the viral vectors, we had the mRNA vaccines, and they worked remarkably well at taking the edge off the severe end of the disease. And you'll remember, because I think we probably talked about it, certainly Greg and I had talked about it, and that is, it was always our intention to stop people dying face down in intensive care units, which was horrible. And I think we did that. And by the spring of 2021, we'd fixed that problem with the vaccines, which was great. But the truth is, there's a lot about the vaccines we don't know, and we still don't know. And as time goes on, we're kind of getting a better sense. So they don't really stop transmission of the virus. They're not very durable, the mRNA vaccines' durability, what, 5-6 months? You know, these are not great vaccines. So we need good vaccines for that and other respiratory pathogens. But everybody sort of said, oh, well, we fixed that, and we've sort of walked away. And I think the Moderna deal is an interesting deal. I chair their advisory group, so I know I'm quite close to them. They're a great company, they've done a good job. But that's not the answer. You can't go, tick, we've now done vaccines. Oh my goodness me, you can't. And what is interesting is that the pandemic has spurred a renewed interest in developing new platforms for vaccines that could be fantastically powerful, but they don't seem to have any traction in the UK. So for example, there's some beautiful work coming out of Pam Bjorkman's lab at Caltech. And that is, if you take nanoparticles and you put a mosaic of a whole range of different coronaviruses on a single nanoparticle, then antibodies can cross-link to two different types of coronaviruses or different variants of the coronavirus. And what that does is it makes the antibodies that you generate not directed at the highly variable bits of the virus, but at the conserved bits of spike. So the chances of being able to get a response which protects you against a whole range of coronavirus, not just COVID-19, but also all the other sarbecoviruses, the chance of getting that is quite high. So who's doing that in the UK? Well, you know, I don't get it, actually. There really isn't much going on. And even though the spycatcher platform, which is what they're all using, guess what? Came out of Oxford, Mark Howarth and others. So, you know, I think these are all examples of us perhaps losing the plot a bit on where we could get to.
Quite a lot to unpack in that. Perhaps we'll talk about that in more in extra. But he was also, as you've just seen, warning of a new pandemic. So let's see what he said about that.
I mean, I bet the house on it. It's definitely going to happen. So everybody should just get used to that. The real question is, what is the likelihood of that happening in the short term? It will definitely happen in the medium or long term, for sure. And as you know, there are many things pushing humans together with a wide range of different species. We're doing a lot of things that are very high risk. Climate change is not going to help with that because insects are moving all over. So, some of the better estimates suggest that there's a 20 or 30% chance of having another pandemic in the next 15 or 20 years. That's a big number. Now, whether it's as really profound pandemic or one that's not so bad, I think we have to wait and see. But it seems inconceivable to me that we won't have another big event.
Sorry, Debbie, I'm trying to keep my face straight here. Insects are moving all over. Yeah, including into our food supply. I mean, this guy is off his head.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why it's very important for people to watch the select committees. And it's why we try to watch them and pick them apart. Because clearly he's lost the plot. He admitted it. He's lost the plot. My next clip, what I'm going to say to everybody watching is, do not adjust your sets. Don't reboot what you're watching. Don't adjust your volume. There is a reason that I'm showing you this next clip, because I have a lot of questions for Sir John Bell. And when he starts talking about the MHRA, my ears prick up. So let's see what he said about the MHRA.
In many of our inquiries, we've looked at the regulatory framework, and of course that the flexibility has really enabled the work to come forward to get a vaccine into people's arms quickly. What has happened since, and what does have to happen to ensure that we've got that future preparedness in the regulatory framework?
Yeah, so again, regulator did a great job. I think there's no question MHRA was a stunningly good regulator. But as you also know, that because of they moved the EMA to Europe, the regulators actually lost quite a lot of resource. They shrunk their capacity. And one of the things that I'm very worried about is we're now subcritical in terms of the number of people we have with bums on seats in the regulator. Where you discover stuff, you develop it, you translate it, you regulate it, and you put it into people. If you do need resource for a regulator to work in this modern world, I think we do need to look quite hard about whether we are giving them enough resource to keep them in the right place.
What did he say? What happened? So thank you to Kenny from our technical team, who sent an email and said that he was watching. We were watching the Health and Social Care Committee and it went blank and what was happening and there was no sound. We'd gone to look for the transcript of the meeting, but we couldn't find it. And then all of a sudden, after that was sent, the transcript appeared. So here's the transcript, the Health and Social Care Committee that was held on the 4th of March. And the next slide, you'll see the highlighted piece of what we didn't hear and what we didn't see. And it would appear that Sir John has a different idea about the MHRA to the one that I have. Because what he's saying is that there's a risk that by not funding the MHRA and by not giving them the resources that they need and by not putting bums on seats, i.e. filling job vacancies, then the MHRA was in a very dangerous place and we need to keep them in the right place. But I heard at the MHRA board meeting that they had a £4 million surplus. And also that they had no job vacancies, all their jobs were filled, and everything in the MHRA department was fine and rosy. So I've got a lot of questions, and especially for Sir John Bell, perhaps he's not being informed properly. I don't know.
Well, maybe he's not being informed properly. Maybe he's not being informed properly by the MHRA. Maybe the question should go to them as well. So thank you, Debbie, for that. But the question is, we began the program talking about extremism and the alleged potential for damaging our democracy, in inverted commas. Ben, there's a bit more going on, perhaps.
There's a lot more going on, isn't there? Yeah, I think the one of the most important words is innovation. The introduction of new things. Everyone's talking about innovation. So John Bell was talking about innovation in pharmaceuticals. We're seeing it in technology. We're seeing it in ideologies. And one of the best examples I've come across recently is the open source DIA platform from Ukraine. So DIA, I think I'm saying that correctly, is a digital government platform. It was launched in 2020. It allows Ukrainian citizens to access state services. So things like driving license, passport have all been digitized. But it is also integrated into the war effort as well. So you can report enemy movements. You can report damage to buildings. And this is all no doubt linked into the AI systems being run by Palantir on behalf of the Ukrainian government. And they've now open sourced it. So Mykhailo Fedorov, the Minister of Digital Transformation, made this statement. From now on, DIA is an open source product. Governments interested in Ukrainian digital transformation experience are more than welcome to study, improve, and implement DIA's code. Big step for our team and Ukrainian tech community. IT professionals will be able to create something similar to DIA or with the same core logic as DIA. He then went on to say, open source is one of the world's top practices. For example, European COVID-19 certificates, European Digital Identity Wallet, Linux, Android, MySQL companies also work as open source products. I hope the Ukrainian digital experience will help other governments to build their own states in a smartphone. DIA opens for the world. Right. So they've basically taken this code base that they developed. And he's right. Open source is a good way of approaching things. A lot of the leaders in technology take this approach, but the question is, where is this code coming from and what is it supposed to do? So this is the Ukrainian government in a smartphone, right? And they've made this available to all international governments. If you plan to digitize your government, you're in the process of implementing your vision of digital transformation, and you are in search of a great GovTech solution, then this might be the one, right? So they are offering this as a service to governments and to IT professionals. They give them a library of assets, the core code base to use and adapt and to change. That includes the front end, so the actual application experience that you have as a citizen, as a user, which if you bring the slide up, you can see there on the left-hand side, so that's what the driving license looks like. But then also, really importantly, the back end, the core logic and how data moves into and around the system. And if you think about code, a really good way of thinking about code is that it is law, right? So technology defines the fundamental processes that underpin our core societal systems in government and elsewhere. And what the Ukrainians, who sit right at the center of global plans to build back better after the pandemic, with all that money from people like BlackRock flowing around, all of the interests from global governments, they are looking to take their code, their law, make it available and have that distributed as an innovation more broadly across different countries, right? So you can think of this as a Trojan horse, the way that I see it, right? So you've got Mikhailo Fedorov. Look at me, I made a meme, mum. Check me out. I'm on the internet doing bits. Look, he's brought his gift, the open source deer, to the nation states, but inside is the NWO. That's absolutely what that is. It's how I see it. So that's one example. Let's have another look at a different example, this time here in the UK, focused on social housing, remote monitoring, and the whole net zero agenda.
We're really delighted to have been selected to be on the Diatomic project. It's given us an opportunity to move into a slightly new direction and develop our product for social housing in Birmingham. We're both from Birmingham and it's a Birmingham-based company, so we're really excited about doing that. The Osmium system allows managers and engineers in a wide variety of companies to remotely monitor and control their equipment without having to be physically present. I approached my co-founder Ulf in 2018. We'd taken on a fleet of wind turbines which needed a remote monitoring system, and we created the monitoring and control system that we needed and called it Osmium. We decided to take that out into wider industrial settings, monitoring and controlling automated equipment. One of the main benefits of having the capability to monitor energy in real time is cost, because as we all know, energy prices went sky high, so everyone has become more conscious about their energy use. Birmingham City Council has identified some flats and some houses in East Birmingham where residents have kindly agreed to let us come in and evaluate the effectiveness of retrofit measures that the council are taking. And we will be monitoring the usage before, during and after the retrofit to see how effective it's been.
The user interface that we have designed has two parts. One is showing the live data, and the other part is showing historic data in forms of charts or tables. And you can choose, do you want to see what happened today or last week or last month, last year? You can see if you have used energy in the wrong way at the wrong time.
So when we deploy Osmium for energy monitoring, it's usually in the context of a consumer unit like this. We simply insert for each circuit a pulse meter, a contactor, and the Osmium device, which communicates with the internet so that engineers and managers can keep track of energy use and control circuit by circuit when that circuit's on.
There's a remote monitoring device. And we talked last week about the Connected Places Catapult and the global digital control grid for cities. Well, here you can see it playing out in real time. This is being built currently in the West Midlands under the auspices of the West Midlands Combined Authority, whose Mayor Andy Street we spoke about on the show last week. You've also got Birmingham City Council in there, the Connected Places Catapult that I talked about last week. It's all about social housing, connecting it up to a digital monitoring system. And you can see how that would play directly into, for example, the NHS Virtual Ward Initiative that we spoke about again last week, right? So this is the control infrastructure for this system that they're building. And it's being pushed out through these innovation accelerators. They're all around the country. There's a big push towards this. Plexel, the UK Innovation Lab based at the Olympic Park, have been talking about this week. They're actually very excited because Flexel CEO Andrew Ruffin, we can flick on, there's a little statement here. He's going to be on stage next Wednesday on the 20th at the Connected Places Catapult, Connected Places Summit. He's going to be talking about the importance of innovation clusters, and he'd know quite a lot about that, given that he runs a innovation lab for the UK government. He's a really interesting character, actually, Ruffin. And I'm talking about innovation, and we've talked about DIA and digitized state and these new digital monitoring systems that are being rolled out. But that's being enabled by innovation in ideology, actually. So Andrew Ruffin came onto my radar last year as the chairman of My Life, My Say, which is the UK youth charity currently indoctrinating the nation's young people into extreme left-wing political ideologies. It's directly connected to, amongst other organisations, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, obviously, NCS, which is chaired by David Cameron, Sadiq Khan's office as the Mayor of London, but also the Rothschild family, two branches. So they've got R&Co Four Generations, which is the Rothschild family based out of Paris, and then also Tortoise Media, who we spoke about earlier, who are directly linked to the UK-based Rothschild family, as well as the US State Department, and via Plexel, where Andrew Ruffin, as we've just spoken about, is the chief executive, into a number of government departments, including the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. So these are the people, these are the organisations, these are the vested interests coordinating and pushing this whole agenda forward. I just want to reference how they think they're going to do this. We talked a lot about democracy and the rule of law and all that kind of thing, extremism earlier on today. Well, MLMS, I believe, is working night and day to derail our democratic process. They ran this event in 2021 called the Common Futures Forum. Note the language, common futures, common purpose, all this stuff ties together. They've been working with people such as Shola, Dr. Shola. I'm not going to pretend that I can pronounce her surname. You may be well aware of her. She's a Nigerian-British media mouthpiece, in my view, a racist hate preacher, ultimately. I mean, she's an absolute absolute firebrand of a left-wing commentator. And she was joined on that panel by Al Sharpton, who is essentially the same thing, but from a couple of generations earlier on from the US. I'm sure you'll all be familiar with Al Sharpton. And he's actually been in the country over the past couple of weeks hanging out with Lord Woolley, who is, amongst other things, the principal of Homerton College, Cambridge. And I think that Ruffin, MLMS, Plexel, the Connected Places Catapult are all conspiring to do some radical and extreme and transformational things to the country.
Thank you, Ben. So we began with extremism. We've ended with extremism. Well, actually, we haven't quite ended because there's another example of extremism. Debbie.
There is. I'm going to whiz across the pond to Tennessee at the House Health Committee. This is Bill 1894. Now, if a food source has a human pharmaceutical product. Right.
Debbie, you dropped out there. Just say that again. Just start off with if a food source.
Right. If a food source has a human vaccine in it, it should be deemed a pharmaceutical product because of the dangers of underdosage and overdosage. Now, I know that sounds crazy. We're talking about human vaccines in food. However, Bill 1894, which was being put forward by Scott Sepicki in Tennessee, was proposing exactly that, to classify any food that contains a vaccine as a drug. Does that sound completely ridiculous? Possibly, but let's listen.
The basic premise of the bill is if a food source has a human vaccine in it, we would deem that a pharmaceutical in Tennessee to make sure that we don't overdose or underdose that food source and then compromise the efficacy of the drug.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Chairman Clemens, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me an example of a food that's a vaccine?
You recognize?
Yes, sir. University of California, Riverside, has already perfected the ability to put human vaccines into our lettuce right now. Also, tomatoes has the ability to do that also for UC Berkeley. And then Big Tobacco, RJ Reynolds and stuff, has perfected the ability to put a human vaccine into tobacco products.
Chairman Clements?
And is that even legal to do in the state of Tennessee, to sell those with a vaccine in them?
You recognize?
I'm not arguing that point. What I'm saying is there is no law deeming those that when you go into a grocery store, you should know as a consumer, this head of lettuce is a head of lettuce. The head of lettuce right next to it could contain a vaccine in it. All we're saying is if it does have the vaccine in it, make sure it's listed as a pharmaceutical so people can get the proper dosage.
You recognize?
Thank you. Well, my question is right now, can you walk into a grocery store and there be a head of lettuce for sale that has a vaccine in it? I don't think that's allowed under state law presently. And if it is, and you have to list it as a
pharmaceutical,
are we going to then have Walgreens pharmacists with a refrigerated section? I mean, how's this going to play out?
You recognize?
Thank you. This is more of a consumer protection bill right here, is to make sure that if you're going in to buy tomatoes and there's a polio vaccine in there, that you are aware of what you're buying has a polio vaccine. The problem you have is if it's not treated as a pharmaceutical, being the size and difference between you and me, how many tomatoes do I have to eat to get the proper dosage versus how many tomatoes that you have to eat? And if you eat too many, do you get a overdose?
So, Debbie, at first glance, this might seem like a completely ridiculous assertion or suggestion, but we're already being softened up for it. So aside from the mass medication of fluoride in water supply, if you remember a couple of years ago, the UK government announced the mass medication of the entire population that eats bread because they've started putting folic acid in bread because folic acid has an impact on pregnant women. So instead of taking a supplement, they just eat bread. This is something that we've already accepted as a population, folic acid in bread. And so it's not a massive step to see that they were already preparing us for this type of thing coming down the road.
Yeah, and that's the terrifying thing, I think, really, in that it's normalizing this, that, you know, fluoride, for example, keep tuned, because next week we're doing a brilliant interview exactly about fluoride, and we're medicalizing the water. It's a medication. Nobody's consenting to any of this in bread. You don't know how much is in bread or how much is in water. So keep tuned for this. But sadly, yeah, it's a reality.
Yes. Okay. Well, look, we've got to end it there for today. So I'm going to say thank you very much to Debbie and Ben for joining me today. Thank you all for joining live. If you haven't seen it live, do join us next week for more live UK Column news. But we hope everybody has a great weekend. Stay tuned if you're UK Column members for some extra. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.